Hi, everybody. My name is Larry Thomas, and I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank Adam for that little introduction. I was expecting a little more, but it's fine. He picked us up at the airport yesterday morning, and I made the mistake of asking, "How you doing?" You know, and he just stopped about an hour ago. You know. And we were in his little, is it a RAV or something like that? Amigo, yeah. He calls it the Schmegmobile. And I know why now. There's more DNA in that car than the FBI lab, you know. We got here, and, you know, all weekend long, people are making a beeline to Ohio from here, you know what I mean? And here we come into here, and the first guy, we roll up to the lobby out there, and Al comes out of the hotel with a raincoat and hip waders, you know, and he's, "Come on, I'll take you to your room," you know, and okay, Al, you know, and he says, "There's a fridge, there's a microwave, and you got some water in there." Well, he wasn't kidding, man. We got there. There was plenty of water all through that place, man. We were about a foot deep in water. And I'm a plumber, and I know that when you look in a toilet and the water's waking like that, you know, we got a log coming or going somewhere, man, you know. So I'm glad to be out of the room, really. I mean, if you guys want to go to coffee afterwards or anything like that, let's hook up now, all right? I mean, let's make dinner plans, you know, anything you guys, we'll start a dance somewhere, you know. But, I'm with some good buddies here and a lovely wife. And I tell you, there's nothing like being in the middle of AA, you know. My sponsor tells me that I'm living proof that a man can stay sober for close to 28 years. Not amount to a damn thing, you know, so I don't know where you're thinking if you're going if you're new, but the highest I've ever gotten here was sober, basic human being, active member of my own home group, which is as high as I need to get, you know. I've sponsored some guys that have gotten higher than that, and they're totally useless to anybody and anything around them, you know what I mean? And that's what I never want to do, is become useless to you. I always want to remain small enough to be useful to you. And anybody can fly around and talk, but how many of us are putting hands on and getting our meeting started? See, that's where I belong. That's why it's important to me that I remember from whence I came, you know, that I never want to get bigger than my home group. And that's why I'm glad to be with my buddies who are still active member of their home groups, you know. I've always been a loser. I'm a hostile loser. And there's nothing like a pissed off loser, you know. And besides being a loser and mad about it, I'm strapped with a 5-inch belt of lazy ass that don't want to do anything about it, you know what I mean? Keep that edge on, you know, at all times, you know. Get mad at you because you're doing well and just, you know, "Well, I'll start tomorrow," you know. And that bothered my dad, you know. And when you're a loser like me and you're growing up, people are always bringing people to your attention to compare you to, you know. And why don't you try to be like Bobby, for God's sakes, you know? He's doing good, you know, and he's a loser, you know. And I got into high school finally, and, you know, I'm a freshman, and got drunk on campus, and they took me to the principal's office. And me and my dad and the principal are sitting in the principal's office, and my dad's disgusted again, and he looks over on the wall, and he sees the star quarterback. And he says, "Jesus, jackass, why don't you try to be like Coy, you know?" he's right down the street. He's a jackass like you. And look at him, man. You know, he's a star quarterback. And, you know, why don't you try to be like him? I said, all right, Pop. Next year rolled around and I got arrested on campus again for being drunk and loaded on barbiturates. And I stole the janitor's cart and I drove it through the library door, you know. And had to get that book back, you know. And and me and my dad and my probation officer are sitting in the principal's office, you know, and the probation officer says, look at Larry, why don't you try to be like Coy? He seems to be doing good, and he's a loser like you, you know. And I said, all right, I'll give it a shot. Next year, my sister starts dating this guy and brings him home. Yeah, old number 7, right there on my couch, you know. And my mom comes running over in her muumuu, and why don't you try to be like Coy, you little son of a bitch, you know. I said, all right, I'll give it a shot. My senior year, I'm going to be doing 90 days in the county jail. And I'm at the Torrance Jail, and somebody slides the Daily Breeze newspaper in there, and it says the headlines in the sport, you know, Coy Hall makes all pro CIS. And I go, God, I'd like to be like Coy. This guy's just moving right along, you know, and he's a loser like me, you know. And what goes around comes around in old A&A town, and I'm about 5 years sober, and I'm in downtown Los Angeles, and I'm in my plumbing truck, and I got the cardboard rolled up because I can't afford a window, you know, and things are going good for me, you know. And and it's vogue over there in L.A. that on every street corner, they got these guys selling oranges or peanuts, or they have this cardboard sign that says, I'll work for food, right? Like you don't. Maybe you don't. I don't know. You know, terrible weather over here, you know. And I'm at the stoplight, and you know, I see this guy with the sign, and I go, oh, you know, I got $2, and he ain't getting it. You know, I'm a giver in AA, for God's sakes, you know. And I'm the kind of guy that looks like needs help. People are always coming to me and stuffing pamphlets and telling me that Jehovah and all these other guys are coming to town, you know. And sure enough, I lock eyes with this guy, and he looks at me, and he comes walking over to my van, and he sticks his head in through the cardboard, and he goes, Larry, Larry Thomas. And I go, Coy. You know, I thought, my God, I thought this guy had it made. I thought he was a loser like me, you know. And then it dawned on me that if there was any justice in AA, that maybe my sponsor could write him a little letter saying, why can't you be like Larry? You know? He hasn't gotten around to that letter yet, but everybody's always seemed like they've had their game on, you know what I mean? And I don't know what game we're supposed to be playing, man, you know what I mean? I wouldn't be able to read the directions. I've always been a guy that can outside do what you're doing, but inside just get no satisfaction out of it whatsoever. Just wondering what the hell's wrong with me and nothing around me to validate it. You know, that make me feel that goofy. I come from great people, you know. I was born in Detroit. I came out to California when I was about 3 or 4 years old. Mom and Dad split up, so I was in a foster home for a while over there in Gardena and San Pedro and stuff, and they finally got together. And Mom's a great lady. Mom is a little Scandinavian lady, and Mom loved diet pills. Mom was always running around the house around 4 o'clock in the morning, sorting out nuts and bolts all night, you know. And raking the neighbor's yard around 3 in the morning, you know. We got her a gas power edger one night, and she took those pills and reared up that engine and started doing the whole block, you know. And just a great lady, busy lady, always doing shit. No matter what time you got up, she's doing stuff, cleaning stuff with your toothbrush, you know. And I'll be done in a minute, you know. And I had no idea it was my first tweaker, you know. I mean, and, you know, just a busy lady, and, you know, no matter what time you got up, she was up doing stuff. She'd eat that speed and make Afghans. So everything in the house had fresh Afghans on it, you know. Every week on the couch and the chairs, there was fresh Afghans. My dad's golf clubs had little poodle heads she knit, you know. And, you know, if there was animals around the house, they had a fresh vest on, you know, and everything was tight and pink, just like her, you know. And she was a good lady, and I knew she loved me well. Make no mistake about that. I used to go with her. She, you know, on her favorite hobby was to go to the drugstore, and she used to eat that speed and make these big jigsaw puzzles. You know, these 30 million piece jigsaw puzzles, you know, of the Mojave Desert. It's going to be a beige night tonight, son, you know. And she'd go to Savon's or get her carton of Raleigh cigarettes because she saved the coupons to buy more yarn. It was a hideous cycle she was caught up in, you know. And she'd come home, eat that speed, put that stinky peroxide on, you know, and put her one and only muumuu on she had for 40 years, you know, and make these jigsaw puzzles, you know. And if she got a piece that didn't fit, well, she had a big pair of toenail clippers, and she'd snip that son of a bitch down, you know, force it in there, you know. And she was pretty intense, you know, and she was into doing chores, you know, and but I knew she loved me well, you know, and I never want to forget what was to come out in a fourth and fifth step, a pattern that would follow me along with some other ones, is what I would do with people that would give me love and affection and attention. Starting with my mom all the way up until and after I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, I would play them like a fiddle. And there would never be a time too inconvenient for me not to put the touch on my mom. I never want to forget what it's like to be a young man, 16, 17 years old, and have to go to a little place for a couple weeks and come out of there, and I'm supposed to report at home on Monday, and I don't show up till Wednesday. And I don't show up at home. I show up at my mom's place of business. My mom's working at dry cleaners, and she's doing some other things just to keep us up and stuff. And I remember on a cold April morning, I'm standing at this dry cleaner's. My mom had no idea where I'd been. And it's raining like it is now. And it's about 9 o'clock in the morning. And I'm in the parking lot of this dry cleaner's. And about from here to that lobby door is my mom's place of business. And I'm just standing in the parking lot with this rain running over me, with the only thought is she better have a buck. For me to walk through that rain, go through my mom's place of business where she works, and one more time startle her with my presence, which would be an ongoing thing. And I walked into that lady's place of business, and I did the only thing that I thought would do, and is, you know, let me have a buck. And she opens up her little Woolworth wallet, and a picture of me falls out when I'm 8 years old on a Little League team. The only decent picture that lady ever had of me. And she starts giving me the $1 and then $2. And I grab the money and I run off to Wilmington where I'm going to die. Now, the thing that brings it home to me isn't all that, is this. If you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, you take the same man and bring him to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous where I'm so-called desperate and willing to go to any length. And my life depends on my actions with you. And you put me in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I need to ask you this. If you were to put a secretary that same distance as me and my mom in that dry cleaner's, how come when my life depends on it, I can't walk that same distance when my life depends on it and ask that man for a job and a meeting that's going to save my life? But I can walk that distance time and time again and break that lady's heart, you see? And I've come to learn by the actions of Alcoholics Anonymous and the principles in this program that if my alcoholism doesn't kill me, my selfishness and my self-centeredness will. Make no mistake about that, which is why it's necessary for a man with close to 28 years to be close to and active in a program called Alcoholics Anonymous, and even more important, a home group. Because if there's anything that I'm going to share with you this weekend, I hope you remember this. I will never get so sober that I can't get drunk again. I will never get that sober, but I can get so drunk that I can't make it back. And I never want to forget what it's like to stand outside your meetings you're having and watch you through those doors and through those windows and wonder if I'll ever get a part of this thing. I wonder if I'll ever be in the middle of this thing called AA or anything else in my life. Because that's where I stood my entire life, on the street of life, watching the train go by and watching all you guys go by it and wondering how you hop on that damn train. And there's an interesting article in the book Alcoholics Anonymous and some of our literature that Gary was talking about last night. And there's an old guy, I believe it was Father Ed, that talked about it. He said Alcoholics Anonymous is like a train station. You go into the train station and people have maps of where they're going. They have tickets of where they're going. They even have pictures of the place they're going to arrive to. But he says the fact of the matter is nobody's ever been on the damn train. And man, that's like me. I never got on this thing called life, more or less the train of Alcoholics Anonymous, just always watching things go by. Now, my dad was a happy drunk. My dad was a happy singing the blues, Nat King Cole, Bobby Darin drunk. My dad loved to drink and sneak into his own damn house. It was an amazing thing, man, you know. And I can tell because he was a refinery worker and he had these big boots. And he'd always sneak in through my bedroom window around midnight, you know. And I could tell because that big boot would come down on my chest, you know. And I grabbed that thing one night and I said, Dad, I said, you know, why don't you have Mom make you a set of keys, you know. My God, she's up anyway. You know, I can hear the Hoover going now, for God's sakes, you know. And I tell you, man, my dad, he was just a great man. He was an idol for a while. And you know, just one of these World War II vet used to tell me, you don't know how good you got it. Back when I was your age, I really had it tough. And he was absolutely right. I never knew how good I got it. I haven't been strapped with that character of gratitude, you know. He says, back when I was your age, we really did have it tough. And he did. His father choked on his tongue after a drunk and bit off his tongue. Mother hung herself in a Detroit jail. She was a drunken whore. And he had a dream, and that dream was to marry my mom. She was in a convent, you know, and he wanted to get her out of that convent, marry her. He wanted a clean one, you know, and he bring her to California, you know. And their dream was to raise a little family over in California and for their children never to want for anything. And that's why they worked themselves to the bone, is so we wouldn't have to live the life they did. And I'm wandering around whining where they're at and stuff like that. And my dad used to tell me, you don't know how good you got it, kid, you know. And he wound up raising his kid brother and stuff like that. And they had a dream, and I became the nightmare of that dream. And all my dad wanted me to do was be good. And I'm the type of guy that doing good doesn't make me feel good. Doing good doesn't make me feel good on a long-term basis. It may make you feel good about me, but it does nothing for me. I have the attention span. I'm impatient. I'm restless. I'm irritable. I'm discontented. I don't need as much sleep as a lot of people, and I just can't stay in the now. I'm afraid of tomorrow and fearful of what I did yesterday, and I'm just so restless and irritable and discontented that no matter how normal I behave, the goofier I feel. And I would do that, and around 11 years old, sobriety stopped working, you know. I couldn't stand being good for him anymore, you know what I mean? I just, you know, Jesus, Dad, you know. And that didn't come to my mind. All I know is, man, I just knew I couldn't do these things he wanted me to do. And they were very simple. When I turned 13, he gave me a list of them on a yellow piece of paper. Now that you're a young man, here are the things you should start looking forward to do. About the fifth one on the list, I said, man, I haven't a chance at this, you know. I haven't a chance at this. And I didn't want to look forward to the responsibility. If there's anything that's ever made me thirsty, is to think that I've got to be responsible. I have ran from responsibility my entire life. Don't mention commitment to me. I don't even want to hear about a 401k. I'm out of here, you know. And at 11 years old, we were playing baseball, and we went into a guy's garage, and we started passing around a bottle of Four Rose whiskey. And I didn't have to think about being good anymore. I felt better than I'd ever felt my entire life, and I hadn't even been good. I knew that I would never have to be good my entire life, and I took a shot of this stuff, and I tell you, it made me feel better than any home run I'd ever hit. Now, I didn't head off to Skid Row that next day. I threw up and I spun around and I couldn't look, you know, I couldn't wait to do that again, you know. And it wasn't hard to get. I didn't have to go around, you know, begging for it. It was all over my dad's garage. And I started out on my dad's, it was Santa Fe port wine. And he had some 102 beer. And then he had his bourbon, you know, hidden out. And, you know, by the time I got into high school, kids were going to their lockers to get their books, and I was going to my lockers to take barbiturates to take away the shakes, you see. And, you know, I got into high school and started hanging around these. And I've always been anxious to do whatever it takes for me to get out of the house. You know, my dad would be sneaking in one window and I'd be sneaking out the next. You know what I mean? And I felt more comfortable part of life underneath the street light at midnight than I did my own dinner table. I didn't know about that. But I've always felt like a guest, no matter where I've been my entire life. I've never felt a part of anything. I have been trying to integrate and be a part of things my entire life. And no matter what I do, I can never make that connection with me and the people around me. There's always that mysterious barrier, you know. And I got into high school, and I've always been interested in cars. I started getting interested in drag racing and stuff like that when I was a young kid, and they'd have me chasing tools. And I finally got into high school, started dating this Mexican girl, and she had some brothers, and they liked cars. They liked lowered cars. We used to lower our cars down to the ground, about this high off the ground, get our hair up real big like a Bakersfield tumbleweed, you know, and yeah, drive around with our white t-shirts and black khaki pants up to here, you know, driving around, listening to the Four Tops and the Temptations and the OJs and Marvin Gaye, and God, I loved it, man. In my plumbing truck about a month ago, the Four Tops come on and just start sinking in my damn truck, man. To this day, man, I listen to My Girl and I just, you know, I love it, man. Started dating this Mexican gal and she had big hair. She used to curl her hair with these big soup cans, you know, and she'd get her hair up real big and I'd drive around with my hair and we'd drink that cheap wine. And the women were telling me that men who are well endowed had big feet. I had a pair of 15-inch shoes I was driving around in, man. I had my big hair, my big feet driving around and, you know, got my frown on because my ass hurts from driving around all night, you know. I'm 110 pounds. I can't lick a stamp, you know. Every now and then I'll start drinking that Thunderbird wine. I'll look at myself in that mirror. I'll put my little puny arm down against that car door to make it look big so you don't mess with me, man, you know. And I loved it, man. We bounced around for a long time, man. I remember one night we bounced into the Jack in the Box restaurant and, you know, Rudy tells me, hey, drive up and talk to the puppet. You know, I can't see the puppet, man. I'm all loaded on that 151 rum, you know. Drive in there, the puppet's yelling at me, can I have your order, please? I wanted to run him down, you know. And I go over to the menu, his head's hanging down, and I run over the damn puppet, you know. And can I have your order, please? You know, he's hanging down. The cops come, they throw me on the hood of the car. They shatter my hair all over the car, all over the parking lot. I don't drive till I'm 30. Big deal. You know, let Rudy drive. I'll ride shotgun all night, man. You know, and there's nothing like riding shotgun. You can drink all night. You can drink that cheap wine all night and look in that mirror. And if you want to get an alky's attention, put a mirror in front of him. Oh, I'm lucky I left my room this morning, man. You know, wow, you know, and I started drinking that wine and looking at myself in that mirror, and I go, my God, are you good looking? Jesus, you ought to be an underwear model or something like that, you know? You're not wearing any, but what the hell, you know? And what are you doing hanging around these Mexicans, man? You ought to take your big hair and big feet and go out there, you know, and be somebody, man. And you look in that mirror and your hair's all bent over because you've been sleeping on the window, you know? You got some cigarette butt stuck in there. You got your little tank top and there's 30 pounds of vomit on you, puke all over. You got tamale paste all over you, you know, and take another drink. And I feel like dancing when I look like that. I don't know about you, you know. Right off to Shanghai Reds, you know, where you're going to find your salsa queen, you know, and go in there and you hear the music and you got to let them know you've been drinking as if they can't tell, you know. And you see your salsa queen, she's over by the bar. You know, and there she is, man, the queen of the night. Her hair's all big. She's got flies stuck in her hair, you know. She's got 30 pounds of puke on her chest. She's over there gnawing on a pickled pig feet, you know. And I like that about a woman, you know. And and I figure I got to have her, you know. So I go over there and I take me and my big feet and my big hair and I start laying it on her. After about 5 minutes, her lesbian girlfriend comes over and starts beating the snot out of me, and, you know, bam, knocks me down, you know, and my big foot's caught between the bar and the bar rail, you know, and I can't get the son of a... She's knocking me down again, and I'm coming up, and she's knocking me down, man, and And for, you know, it seemed like 2 hours, this lady was kicking my ass, man. And I said, my God, when she's get done, I'm going to kick the snot out of her, you know what I mean? And I had no idea I was a victim of gay bashing, you know, but... Finally shook that foot out of there and got out of there, you know, and grabbed my prize catch, you know, and took her over to her trailer in Gardena, you know, and I knew it was a bad idea because it said, don't be knocking if it's rocking on there, you know what I mean? And went into the trailer and woke up the next morning and had to take that 90-year-old woman home, you know, and come on, grab your tanks, let's get out of here, you know, and then... I ran into a kid like that not too long ago. We were over at the Glendale Mall several years ago. I'm walking in the Glendale Mall, and this kid goes walking by me. He's all shaved, bald, got his mom's earrings on, you know. He's got a hook in his eye. He's got a ball bearing in his nose. He's got a ring in his lip, you know. Ball bearing in his tongue, got a chain to his wallet. He's got a big hole in his ear, so in case you lose that son of a bitch, you can just grab him, you know. I think they ought to make some rims and put them in there, you know. Put some spinners in there or something, you know. A clock, an AA triangle, anything, you know. An aquarium maybe, you know. And he walks, you know, and he's got these big pants. You could put about 5 other guys in there with him, you know. And he's got 3 phones because he's an important kid, right? And he walks by me and he goes, what are you looking at? I says, I haven't a damn clue what I'm looking at, you know. I wanted to squirt him with some WD-40 so he doesn't stick anywhere, you know. And what am I looking at, you know. And so we dogged each other for a little bit and then we started talking and now I sponsor him, you know. And lives down, well, he used to live down there by Kip and Vista, you know. His name was Ron. He was an ex-sailor, so you know he had lazy ass strapped around him too, you know. And, you know, and no matter who you sponsor, they got your defect of character times 10, right? And this guy wasn't going to lift a finger, you know. And he used to call me up, you know, sponsor, what do you want me to do? I says, I don't know, Ron, why don't you unlock yourself, for God's sakes, you know. Well, I keep going to these meetings and I feel so different, really. I said, maybe it's that chain link fence you're wrapped up in, you know. I mean, and he wasn't about to go to work, and finally he called me up, you know, and in a general way, and I don't mean to disgust anybody, but I probably will. So he finally got a job, and he was excited. And there's nothing like the excitement of a free man, you know. And this kid was all excited, you know. And I got a job, sponsor. I go, great, Ronnie, great. When do you start? I start next week. You know, he says, I go 2 to 3 times a day. Oh, I said, you got a part-timer? He goes, yeah. I said, what are you going to be doing? He says, well, 2 to 3 times a week, I'm going to be going to a sperm bank. All right. Now, then, you know, and I tried to, this guy is happier than hell. And I could just see him, you know. I could just picture it, you know. Just every morning, packing that lunch, you know. Throwing those gloves in the lunchbox, you know. Grabbing that Hustler magazine and just heading off to work. Just going to go to that hands-on job, I guess. I don't, you know. I mean, how do you talk him out of it, for God's sake, you know? You try not to work any overtime, for God's sake, you know? You'll kill yourself, man, you know? You'll go blind, you know? And then I did what any other sponsor would do. Do they need any help? He's doing good now. He's over in Utah working for Motorola. He's a great guy. You know, and I'm bouncing around these guys. And 1969, everybody's going places. Some people are going to Vietnam. And I thought, well, maybe I'd go to Detroit and find my roots. So I grabbed my buddy and we head off to Detroit. And I landed in Phoenix. Over off of North Central and Roosevelt at the Apache Hotel, and the Apache's got about 6 floors, and everybody's got a TV. It's in the lobby. Everybody's got a bathroom, and it's down the hall. It's about $30 a month, you know. And I don't know how I'm going to get the dough for this place, you know. And I got a little window that I look out of, and the only thing I can see is the wagon wheel bar. And it's ragged curtain. There's no door, just this curtain that blows out of this brick building, which is where I'm going to live and find my people. and I can't wait to get to the wagon wheel, you know, and get out of that room. And I meet a guy named Ernie down there. Ernie's from Tennessee. And Larry, I know what we're going to do. He says, I got a buddy that's a plumber, and he needs some help. Come down here the next morning. And I show up that next morning, and I meet this guy, and he says, come with me, kid. You'll start today. And he sticks me underneath the house. He says, I don't want you to come out of here. He says, all I want you to do is hang copper all day. Don't even think of coming out here. And he gave me a little transistor radio, and he says, I'll come back in 8 hours and pick you up. And he took off. And I had a pint of Kessler's. I had my transistor, and there's this little cat staring at me, you know, and I, man, I'm on top of the world, you know. I mean, I got it made. I got a pint, you know, I got a transistor, got a pet, you know, and nobody knows I'm under here. Every now and then I'll bang on that pipe, you know, and I started hitting that Kessler's, you know, and about 6 hours later they're dragging me out from underneath the house, and apparently I busted up through the floor and robbed a lady of all of her jewelry and some change, and they're dragging me out, and this cat comes running out with a necklace, you know, and got fired from that job, you know, and go back to the wagon wheel. And I know what we're going to do, Larry. He says, not too far from here is a horse track. He says, we're going to get you down to 95 pounds. You're going to be a jockey. Wow. And I'm thinking we're going to start working out and maybe get healthy again, you know. And he had a bag of this speed, and you know, I don't do that. You know, I've just been drinking and doing heroin, minding my own business, you know, and don't mess up anything, you know. And no, he says, I want you to take this stuff, and after, you know, 2 months, we'll go weigh you in, you know. And it looked like he was damn near there, you know. And I'll come back in 2 weeks, and we'll, you know, 2 months, and we'll go weigh you in. Well, he come back in 2 weeks, and I'm in my little room, and I haven't moved an inch. I don't want to be a jockey, Ernie. I'm going faster than any damn horse I've ever seen in my life. You put a saddle on me and ride my ass around here, you know. And I haven't moved an inch, you know, and I've just been chasing a fly around my room and looking out my blinds every 10 seconds. What's that, you know, and black and white flashes all day long, and that's the damn sun going up and down, you know. And you know, just drinking quarts, you know, and worst 16 days of my life, for God's sake, you know. And finally, he got me another job with a guy, and I started working for this kid. I started digging a ditch, and after about 2 hours with him, I just found out that he was younger than me. That was it. And I ain't working for a kid, you know. So I did what any honorable man would do. I faked a knee injury. Went down to the county hospital, you know. On the way there, got another pint of Kessler's, you know. Went to the county hospital, and they gave me a prescription for some Percodan or something like that. Left the box there, a prescription pad, and the doctor took off, and he ain't going to need those, you know. And took the prescription pads, and me and this guy started writing prescriptions and selling them to people down in Nogales and Tucson, and just writing prescriptions for Seconal and Nembutal and Tunol, and you name it all, I wrote it all. You know, damn near took it all, too, you know. And after about 9 months, they caught up with me. Now, when you're loaded on whiskey and barbiturates, there's no freeway chase. There he goes, down to 17. You know, none of that's happening. It's just a matter of the sheriff coming into the Busy Bee Hotel going, well, hell, there he is under there. You know? So they arrested me, and they put me away for a smile. And I'm no big-time convict. I'm just a loser, man. That's all. And little punk loser, and they put me away for a little bit in 1974. They gave me a $45 voucher to come back to Los Angeles, check in with the city hall over there, they give me a little room and put me on Anabuse, and I get a little hotel room in downtown Torrance, the Greyhound Hotel, and it's a great little hotel. Everybody has a TV. It's in the lobby. Everybody has a bathroom. It's down the hall, $28 a month. I can't find the money to make that. And I'm sure that if I just had some type of normal living, everything would be all right. If I can just get the job, the car, and everything at the same time, I just can't get that going. But I'm sure if I can just get all that going, everything would be all right. I'm sure that. But I just can't get it all going. And it seems like sobriety becomes the thing that drives me to drink. And no matter how long I stay sober, the worse I feel. You see? And I don't know about this phenomenon of craving. All I know is that every time I don't drink, the longer I stop drinking, the worse I feel. You know? And for a long, long time, I could sum up my drinking really, really simple. And that is, every time I drank, from the time I was, you know, starting to do it regularly. It seemed like I could take a couple shots of bourbon and I just step into this beautiful place. Just this beautiful, safe place, man, where I am right with everybody and everything. And it is the safest place I know. And there is no doubts or fears about me and everything, man. It's just the safest place that I know. And thank God for the phenomenon of craving that keeps that window open for a guy like me, you know? And the problem with my life is the older I got and the more I drank, the smaller that window got. And the smaller that window got. And the smaller that window got. And by the time I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, there was no stepping into no big, beautiful picture window. There was just this thought that maybe I can get it to open up like a keyhole. There was just this thought that maybe someday I can get that stuff to work like it did. I'm crazy now and it's worth a shot now. And I'm strapped with this thing that every time, no matter, it seems like my worst drunk isn't enough to keep me sober. It doesn't have, I used to think that the memory of my last drunk is enough to keep me sober. But what happens to me is the memory of my last drunk is pushed away by the pain that I feel when I'm not drinking. And I'm the type of alcoholic that every time I don't drink, I can look over 15, 20 years of drinking. And with sober eyes, I can see everybody that I've hurt and maimed and ruined. I'm the type of drunk that every time I get sober, I can see the physical things happen to me. I can see stuff going on with me that I didn't think would ever happen to me. I'm the type of drunk that every time I'm sober, I know of the institutions that I'm threatened with. And every time I stop drinking, I have the ability to come up with a profound conclusion that this time is going to be different. I have the ability to push all that stuff aside, every ounce of knowledge that I know about. I have the ability, it's all pushed aside for this little flimsy flicker of hope that maybe this time it'll be different. It's got to be. I'm sober now and I'm crazy. It's worth a shot. And it's all pushed aside. And I had no idea what the hell that was about. All I know is I bought it every time. I didn't know that I was powerless not to. You know? And I'm in that little gray, I'm over at the Greyhound Hotel and I'm on Anabuse. I get a little job down at a refinery I'm supposed to report to. I'm 3 hours early. I don't got nothing in my system. I have no alcohol. All I got is that Anabuse in me for 3 months. And I'm excited about working at a refinery because my dad co-signed. My dad went to the fire department there and one more time put his name on a piece of paper. I can't tell you the amount of people who went out on the line for me. I'm not a guy, a victim of bad circumstances and tough luck. I had people go out on a limb for me. One more time. Yeah, man. You promise you it? Yeah, okay. And my dad went out on a limb. See, my dad was a man of character. My dad was a hard-working guy. He started off as a janitor and maintenance man of a refinery and wound up being a plant manager, head of OSHA there. And he knew a guy at the Chevron refinery. One more time, he put his ink on there. And I'm supposed to show up, and I show up there early. And it wasn't for the refinery itself, it was for a contractor, and I was going to be shoveling some coal. And I'm there early, and I'm 3 hours early, and I started feeling a little anxious. And so across the street was a Little League field, and I went over to the Little League field. I went into this Little League dugout, and stone cold sober, I went absolutely out of my mind. I don't have an ounce of alcohol or anything. My paranoia got so bad that I was hallucinating. I was in between hysterical and maniacal, and I floated off into a place that I didn't know I would ever return to, and I had no idea what happened to me. But they called the paramedics from Harbor General Hospital. They take me to the Harbor General Hospital, and they put me in the emergency room. They look over my jacket, and they diagnose that some of my drug overdoses have been suicide attempts. And by the looks of some of the things that have been going on with me, that I need to go to a state hospital for 30 to 60 days to be observed. And they sent me off to this state hospital. And a year later, I got out. Totally observed. You know, I'm clean now, you know. And they gave me my little medications to take for some of these mental things, and every one of them worked for those mental things. But you know what you can't medicate away? This time it's going to be different. You can't take that out of an alkie. Because when it comes to the time of that running your life, that little nightmare becomes the only dream you ever have. God damn it, you better hope it's going to be different. And that was the only dream I ever had, man. I am so glad that this program has something to do with God. Because by the time I got to you, that's all I had left. That's all I had left. And I was hoping that this time, but that was my dream. and they couldn't medicate that away. And at the end of 1974, they found me in Overo Street, curled up behind a Chevron gas station. Not a public drunk, a public nuisance. Violation of probation one more time. Little nickel and dime stuff. They rolled me up on a violation and sent me up to the wayside. And I'm up there for 50 days on a $38 bail bonds. You know? $38 bonds. Ain't nobody come pay it off, you know? And I'm up there and after about 40 days, they put about 50 of us in a black and white bus and send us off to the South Bay Courthouse. And I'm in a holding tank about this size. And everybody's gone. 4 o'clock in the afternoon, the buses are gone. Everybody else is gone. I'm on a concrete floor with a Vons bag and no hope, wondering where we're going now. And at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, a Scottish man with a patch came into that holding cell. And he said, "Are you Larry Thomas?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I am." He says, "Why don't you come with me, son? We're going to AA. I said, "My God, what is AA? I've heard of OR and PO, but what's AA? You know, and who's the Scottish pirate all of a sudden, you know?" And I'll tell you who he was. And that guy, you know, looking back 28 years, that guy was what I now call a trusted servant. Now, why would he be a trusted servant? For me, he had no business being there. He wasn't on a panel. He wasn't a part of PI. He wasn't a counselor. He wasn't, he was just a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, a refinery worker who got the worst news of his life. And that is his wife was dying immediately of a terminal disease. And he knew she was in good hands, but he knew he wasn't. But somewhere in that man's home group, somewhere in his book studies, somewhere in his speaker meetings, somewhere in his little group of home group meetings, that man was able to grasp and develop a manner of living that taught him this. Practical experience tells us that nothing will ensure immunity from drinking except intensive work with other alcoholics. This works when other activities fail. And he whipped his car around and he went to the South Bay Courthouse. He talked to a guy named Larry Graham. They talked to Judge Foy and Judge Hollingsworth. And they said, "I think we got a guy for you." And that guy came down to there and he said, "Come on with me, lad. We're going to AA." And he took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1975. And I'm ready for a 100-mile car ride and maybe some lunch up north. And he took me for a 15-minute car ride to my first meeting. And in that car, he nailed me. He says, "Son, I know you've had a tough life and you feel different." And I said, "My God, that's the thing that I've been feeling my entire life is different. No matter what group around, I've always felt different." He says, "Son, I can't wait for these people to meet you. I can't wait for you to meet these people." And he said, "Larry," he says, "I don't care about how different you feel, son." He says, "In Alcoholics Anonymous, the more different you feel, the more qualified you are." And he ran off and he took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, a 15-minute car drive. And he rolled up to this stinky, dingy, smelly, no-good-looking Alano Club, man. And I don't know, I've never seen that word before in my life, Alano. You know, what the hell's an Alano? You know, my dad was in all these animal clubs like elks and moose, and I think it's another animal club, you know, and watch for crossing Alanos or something like that, you know. And rolled up to this Alano club, and all these Alanos are walking around, you know, and they all got nicknames and tattoos, and he starts introducing me to all these goofy people, Indian Genie and Captain Bob and Tennessee Bill and Singing Sam and Serenity Sam and Bicycle Ray and Santa Claus Ray and Dancing Pete and Whistling Butt and all these other people, you know. And I just left a group of people like this, you know, and Little Moose comes running after me. He said, "Hi, honey, my name is Moose. I'm expecting a miracle." I said, "I bet you are." I said, I bet you are. I said, "I'm not it, believe me, you know." And some transvestite came out of the card room. He starts circling me like a helicopter in Norwalk, you know, and three times around, this guy lands and he starts walking over to me in his brand new moo-moo, you know, and "I can't wait to take you to our candlelight meeting." I don't think so. Not till I get a year anyway, you know. I've got my pride. I said, "My God, if that's AA, I don't want any part of this thing, you know. And if that's the effect of that blue book, I don't want to crack that thing open either." And from 1975 to 1982, I came in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous on a regular basis. And that was the biggest lie that I've ever told myself. I hadn't touched AA. I hadn't touched Alcoholics Anonymous. I did what I did my entire life. The pattern of my life is I came in into a room waiting for something to happen to me. I came and sat in a room waiting for somebody to do something for me. That's what I've been doing my entire life, winding up in rooms waiting for people to do something to me, waiting for people to tell me to do things. And that's what I did here. And if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, what has happened to me is what I was waiting to be done to me, God was waiting to do through me. And if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, there's only one thing that I can tell you about. Be prepared to be divinely inconvenienced for the rest of your damn life. I tell you, it has nothing to do with your comfort. Believe me, man, I tell you. In fact, we have to do the uncomfortable to get comfortable here, you know. And what's happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous is Alcoholics Anonymous has taken the only decent thing that I had, which was my feet, and they trained my feet. They trained my feet. They trained my feet. And that's why it's so important for a man like me to have a routine of meetings. Not because I'm a step Nazi, all this, because of a routine of meetings. Because there's nothing worse than being sober and crazy and wondering where I should go tonight. Should I go to the participation? No. Should I go to the speaker? No. I'll just stay home and sift it out. I mean, I've been here for a week anyway. What the hell, you know what I mean? I'll work this shit. I'm on the verge of a breakthrough, you know what I mean? You know, I've damn near got it, you know. However, as some of me and my buddies have experienced, there's nothing like being sober and crazy and knowing where you're going to be in 2 hours. Knowing that the old man's going to be there. Knowing that there's going to be some coffee to pour. Knowing that there's going to be some chairs to put up. Knowing that your buddies are going to be a couple of chairs down from you. There's nothing like that. You see, and that's what I need. My feet have been trained. I'm in that shower all day long and I'm going, I'm not going, I'm not going, I'm not going. I'm really not going. I'm not going. I'm not. There was one day I couldn't wait to tell my sponsor. All day long, I'm about 8 years sober and I'm thinking, I woke up with this, it was at the foot of my bed, man. I did my reading and then this thing says, don't go to your Monday night meeting. You got it. Yeah, it's been a while. I think I'll stay home. And all morning long, man, I'm not going. I'm not going. I'm not going to go. This is great. Called my sponsor. How you doing, kid? I'm doing great. I'm feeling great. What are you going to do? I'm not going to the Monday night meeting. What? Yep, I don't care either. Jimmy crack corn and I don't care. I ain't going, man. And I'm feeling great about it. I need to make a manly decision like that, you know. I'm feeling great, man. I ain't going. I'm feeling good about it. People calling, how you doing? I'm doing great. See you tonight? Nope, I ain't going, man. I ain't going, you know. And I'm loving it, man. Get off of work, 5 o'clock, watching TV, not going. No, I'm not going. 6 o'clock, I'm in the shower. I'm not going. I'm not. 8 o'clock, I'm not going. How you doing? My name's Larry. I'm totally against my will, man. I'm driving to a meeting. I don't want to be. You're sitting next to people I can't stand, giving the son of a bitch a ride at the end of the meeting. You know what I mean? I was just trained to do that. And thank God. Thank God for these routines, because I don't always want to do. I didn't wake up and go, yeah, let's go to the flood areas. Come on, Rosie, pack your bags, honey. We're going to Virginia, and then we'll row to Cuba after this. You know, I mean, I'll get you home to Nicaragua. Don't worry, you know. You know. But that's Alcoholics Anonymous, man. We do the uncomfortable to get comfortable, and it has nothing to do with how we feel about it. It's about what we do. It's about what we do, and everything we do here for people like me is an after effect. You know? And I thank God for these actions. But I'm coming in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous where I thought, and that was the biggest lie that I told myself. And every time I called Alcoholics Anonymous, somebody would come and get me, and they were all clean and sharp like you guys. Which is why we're a tie right now. Not because I think I'm sharp and effective, but because there's a herd of guys over here who taught me how to live. They taught me how to have respect for the thing that's saving my life. See, everything I know about being a man and being a member has to do starting in my meetings. I have nothing to bring to that meeting. Everything that I bring to my life comes from that meeting. Everything I know about being a man, being a member, being anything starts inside that room. And the most important thing in my life isn't my sponsor or the book. It's my chair. And I got to do what I have to do to get in that chair. And anything that keeps a man like me from being in that chair has to be dealt with one way or the other. My life starts in that seat. That's the most important thing in my room, is being in that seat. And I used to think it was because I could see my sponsor, but I had no idea that there's about a handful of goofs looking to see if their sponsor's there. You see, it ain't about telling you what to do. Alcoholics Anonymous has been this process where people share with you what to do, and you get to watch them do the same thing. We lead by example. The only thing I have to run through my life is, am I a distraction or attraction to that group? See, that's what these steps and these principles of the traditions have gotten to me. What type of an attraction have you been to that group? Are you glued against the wall and afraid to talk to anybody that's strange? When's the last time you talked to somebody whose name you don't know? Or are you glued to those herd of guys? I got to get off that wall and come out there, because that's where you guys got me. And I'm in and out of this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous, though I saw it. And every time I called Alcoholics Anonymous, somebody would come and get me. And on May 2nd, 1982, I'm over at the Beacon Light Mission. And I'm in front of this, I'm 120 pounds, I'm in front of the Woolworth window, and I ain't drunk again, but I got everything I own on my back. I'm 120 pounds and I'm yellow. And I catch eyes with the thing, and I've been dodging that thing for a long time. I don't look at myself. I don't look at reflections, mirrors, nothing, but I caught eyes with the thing. Thing's about 120 pounds and he's yellow. He's shaking and he's alone and afraid. Hadn't slept in a long time and he ain't on anything. Just terror. Just that constant terror. And I look at myself in that mirror and I say, my God, you know, I did what I always did when I look like that. I panhandled some money and I called Alcoholics Anonymous. And who do I get? I get Don. I get this Montana cowboy that's been running after me. And every time I call, this guy was one of the guys that was there. And the last time I talked to him, I was in a hotel drinking some PM bourbon. And I told him, get the hell out of my life. Let me do what I want to do, Don. Let me do what I want to do. Nobody's going to tell me what to do. It'll be a cold day in hell before I get another man a cup of coffee in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It'll be a cold day in hell. And that guy left that room. And I called him up and I said, Don, this is Larry. I've just checked into the Beacon Light Mission. Will you come and get me? And he told me the most profound thing I've ever heard in my life. He said, no. He says, you know where we are. You know what we got. Why don't you get your rusty rear down here yourself? I'm tired of chasing after you. And he hung up. I said, my God, whatever happened to that AA love? You know, I said, well, I just heard it. And for the first time in my life, it was up to me to come to you. It was no longer necessary for the good people of Alcoholics Anonymous to be inconvenienced by my nonsense. And I took the longest walk of my life. I walked that 10 miles from Wilmington to Torrance with my poopy pants and no hope. And every step of the way, my head's telling me, you ain't going to make it. You're not going to make it, Larry. You've been there before. You ain't going to make it. And every little liquor store, I wanted to dig in and ditch in and snatch a little short dog to help me there. But I didn't do it. I didn't do it because I wanted to ask that guy something. I wanted to ask that guy something I never asked a man in AA. I had to see that Montana cowboy. And I walked to that club and I asked him where he was. And they said, he's in the back there. And there he was. He was by the coffee bar and he was all by himself. And I waddled up to that guy with my poopy pants and no hope and asked him that thing that I had to ask him. I said, Don, I don't know what to do with my life. Would you be my sponsor? And that guy lit up like a chandelier for about 5 seconds. And then he lit into me for about a half hour. And he told me, under no certain terms am I going to put up with your nonsense. And then he gave me the deal. And it's a very simple deal. You make the effort, I make the effort. You don't make the effort, God dang it, don't hang around me, son. He says, I got too many guys that are doing this thing. And the guy was my sponsor. And I loved him. And I still love him. And I still give him a cake. But after a year and a half, I started getting complacent. After a year and a half, you see, I started out this talk that I was a loser. But let's reel this thing back in. Let's get this thing back into where we live on a fourth and fifth step where we start writing about defects. Let's reel this thing back into where we live when we're sober. It ain't because I'm a loser. My biggest defect of character is I'm a quitter. That's what alcohol allowed me to do, was quit. I can quit before, I can think about things and quit them before I even start them. I'm a natural born quitter in everything I do. I can't wait to quit. There's something about quitting that I love. Because I'm a loser, I don't have that character where you work through things and come out the other end and see the blossoms and all that crap. I'm a quitter, and you know how quitters get hope? They start over. You're always starting over. Your life revolves around starting over. It's a series of fresh starts. This time it's going to be different. New hotel, new probation officer, you know, new sobriety date. Everything's about quit. I don't know how to get hope and work. It was in Alcoholics Anonymous because of these steps and sponsorship and sponsoring people. There's something about being the student of the book, but I tell you, there's even a better payoff when you become the teacher of something you've never done. And I started teaching this thing about things that I started doing. And I began to learn more and more about me being a quitter by sponsoring these other quitters. And you know what we got to do in our life? We installed this principle in Alcoholics Anonymous that's hardly ever talked about. It's called consistency. There is nothing like a consistent man. There is nothing more spiritual than a serviceable man. And you guys talked to me about being consistent. That if you can be consistent in your seat and your commitments, nothing can stop you out there, pal. Nothing. You make this your primary purpose and your priority in your life, everything else will take care of itself. You see, but after a year and a half, I didn't have all that. I started comparing myself and seeing what I didn't have and judging my sponsor. And my sponsor started showing me his imperfections, and I couldn't handle it. So I began to think that I must have outgrown him. My sponsor was just being a man, and it scared me. So I started backing off. And I started running my own life. And at 2 years sober, there's a guy that came down to that club and told me what I was. He says, "You're a loser. You're a taker of people." He says, "There's an AA triangle, kid. I hope you find it." And I followed that man. I followed that man to what I was to call my home group. I never had a home group. And here I'm thinking I'm going to get this guy so he can make me into somebody. And what he did is he turned me into a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, a member of a home group. That's the most important thing in my life. He showed me how to take part in this thing. Stay small. Always have a commitment here. Took me through this inventory. Introduced me to the two most finest people in my life, my mother and father. Started making amends to people that deserved it a long time ago. And it took more than a long afternoon and a lunch. It took that first initial sittings and then constantly showing up in their life. Sitting down with this guy that I couldn't stand because I was ashamed that I was a quitter. My dad wasn't a quitter. But I used that thing as to keep me as a thing to start hating him. And when I got sober, I got to make amends and become that guy's best buddy. He was my closest friend. You guys told me when I sobered up to quit telling everybody that I was sober. Quit telling people you're sober in AA, for God's sakes. You're giving us a bad name, you know what I mean? Every time I tell my mom I'm back in AA, she goes, "Oh God, he's going to drink again," you know? But I started hanging around with these people and I started asking them about their life. And I started doing things for them. I love my mom today. Love my mom to death. She's my best buddy. I love my wife dearly, but I cheat on Rosie every week. I date my mom. I go over there and I be with my mom and massage her feet. Look at her flowers. She loves flowers. She lives in this retirement home, 5 floors. Everybody has a balcony and they all have their real flowers. I'm over there and my mom's got plastic flowers. Yeah. And I took it personal. Yeah, I'm going, "My God, what a chump you are. Everybody's got real roses and your mom's got plastic flowers. What a tightwad. Get her some real flowers." What a grand idea. "Mom, I'm going to buy you some roses." "I don't want any." "No, but you don't have to pay for them. I'm going to put some flower beds and roses and I'm going to water them and take care of them for you. And you'll have real flowers." "I don't want them, honey." "No, you don't understand, Mom. I'm going to do it. You know, I'm just honored." She says, "Larry," she says, "I don't want any real roses. I love my plastic flowers." She says, "I love to sit here and watch my hummingbird suffer." And my dad, I got to take care of his bills and everything like that and become his buddy. He was fond of the World War II and stuff like that. And one of his fondest memories is when I married Rosie. He said, "Please don't let them take me away from my room and in a home. Let me die in my own room." And we made that possible. But one day we came over there, we were asking him about the Pearl Harbor and World War II, and he had all of his World War II memorabilia out, like a display for us to see. And man, I got to see this. This guy was proud of this thing that he served. You hear me? Proud of the thing that he served. How many times have I come to Alcoholics Anonymous and thought this was a step down? How many are you proud of the thing that you're serving? That's the thing that I look for in people. That's the thing you'll find in pockets of enthusiasm. Where you take intense, crazy, goofy people, install some principles, and that intensity is gone, and it's created this thing called enthusiasm for a thing that's bringing them life. That's where enthusiasm comes from. You take these crazy, crazy, goofy people like me, and you put in a program, and you create this thing called enthusiasm for life. And you get that spark lit. And it's so sad to see that spark burning and people sitting in meetings next to that little spark burning telling them, you don't have to do anything. You don't have to do that. But in a pocket of enthusiasm, they recognize the spark and they fan the fire. They fan that fire. Come on, kid, be with us. We're going here. We're doing this. They fan that fire because that fire is very few times is that thing going. So pockets of enthusiasm are as important for a guy like me. That's where I live. I am enthusiastic for this thing called life. I'm enthusiastic to have a daughter that I wasn't supposed to see that me and Rosie get to see, my lovely wife that I met here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And this daughter that you guys told me that just because I was a divorced man, I may not be somebody's husband, but I'll always be somebody's father. And it was the people in Alcoholics Anonymous, it was the men in Alcoholics Anonymous who told me to keep in contact with that little girl, write her every week, don't write her on yellow legal paper, write her on Pocahontas paper, for God's sake. Frank used to tell me if you can ride to San Jose and speak, you can drive to Phoenix and see your daughter, for God's sakes. What is more spiritual? And I remember going over there and seeing my little girl not too long ago and sitting across from me, this little beautiful little girl, 21 years old, and she's got her mom's earrings on and she's got her eyebrow pierced. She got a ball bearing in her nose. She got a ball bearing in her tongue. She got a tattoo on her gut. She said, Daddy, what are you looking at? I said, the most beautiful little girl I've seen in my life. Now, where would I get that? I got that in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got that sitting in rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous where every meeting I sit into, there's guys with earrings on and tattoos and bandanas, and they look like voodoo dolls, but behind every piercing, and every tattoo, there's an alky in there, and that's who I talk to. And behind all of her piercings and all of her tattoos, there's a little girl in there, and that's who I talk to. It ain't about what's out there, it's about what's inside there, and inside there is my daughter. And if I couldn't handle a tattoo or a piercing, what's going to happen when something important or drastic happens to her and she has to come to me? Oh my God, he couldn't handle the tattoo, how's he going to handle this? I was able to handle the tattoo because you people told me to shut up. She can't do anything about it. Move forward. Don't ruin a chance to be serviceable later. Don't ruin a chance to be serviceable later. My wife told you about those terrible tragedies that she had, her sponsor and her mother passing away. The best direction that I got, let her cry in your arms and don't give her any damn advice. And I can't tell you the nights that that little lady curled up in my arms and she sobbed her little self to sleep and I didn't have to tell her what we're going to do about it. I just let her cry in there. And I didn't have to give her my advice. I gave her my shoulder, which was strong because of the people of Alcoholics Anonymous told me how to do that. I got a lovely life today. I got a beautiful wife that I met 11 years ago. 11? Give me a sign if I'm close, baby. You know, yeah. And I met her in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I, you know, went down to one more time. I had to speak at this Downey meeting, and I didn't want to go. You know, and it was dry. You know, And it was one of those meetings where everybody's in wax and they're just like a Botox meeting. There's no smiles, you know. You know, like that. Damn near sent Frank. Went down to that meeting And during my talk, I locked eyes onto this little Nicaraguan lady, and I couldn't keep my eyes off her. And at the end of the meeting, people are thanking you and hitting you and telling you what a lousy job. And I followed her out to her car like a terrier, you know. And we're standing there talking, you know, and my tail's wagging, you know. And she goes, do you like the backpack? And I said, I love it. I never backpacked a day in my life, for God's sake, you know. I spent enough time out there, you know, and I figured, what the hell, anything to get into the tent, you know. And I've been calling that lady ever since, every day. And you told me how to be a husband. You taught me how to be a good husband. You taught me how to be a loyal man. You taught me how to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. To be a loyal man. To not ruin a chance to be useful later. And it's been tough. It's been tough being me around you because I don't know who I am a lot of times. But to have that in the comfort of a loving house and watch me stumble around trying to fake myself through being a good husband and stuff like that, I can't tell you how comfortable it is to do it with you. I love you. Never want to bring harm to her. You see? But as long as I keep my life an open book to me and my friends, I sat next to Frank for 20 years in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he watched me go through stuff, and I watched him go through. And it dawned on me not so long ago, we never even broke bread together. And I wanted to start knowing some of these guys that I call friends. I wanted to start knowing some guys like Kip and stuff like that. And I didn't know how to do it. And it was real simple. My sponsor said, why don't you ask him and his wife out to eat? Real simple things like that. And I do that. And I feel like I'm coming apart of this thing. You know, I don't have this thing in wraps. I don't know how to mix. I'm not a mixer. But I know what? I want to be a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want that. I want that more than anything. I want to find this power that you guys talk about. I'm still divinely thirsty. My thirst hasn't been quenched here. I'm still thirsty for what you have here. I have the excitement of coming to seeing you guys every time I'm with you. I don't know much about God. I don't know what He looks like. All I know is this. I've never been able to separate God and AA. I can't think about Him without thinking about you. And I can't think about you without thinking about Him. But I know this. Saturday morning in Virginia Beach, I see row after row after row of people who should be locked up dead or insane. At least over here. And I don't know much about God. Don't know what He looks like. But several years ago, there was a man in Flagstaff who used to have me talk at his meeting. And he had a big, beautiful house in Flagstaff, Arizona. And it was a custom-built house. His name was Frank Hanna. He passed on. In every window of his house, he had what they called a peak view of the mountains. Whether you were in the kitchen or the den or the bathroom, you could look out a window and see the peak view of God's handiwork. And in every window of my life, I got a picture. Every window of my life, I got a picture. And in every picture, you're in it. I can't think of one area of my life where I can't see the people of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not one area where I can't see you guys. And for a man who don't know much about God or what He looks like, I feel like I'm with Him all the time. Because like I say, on a Saturday morning in Virginia Beach, there's row after row of people who should be locked up dead or insane. And look at us now. Look at us. All weekend long this morning, we've been happy, joyous, and free. So I may not have to look at His face, but by golly, we've been playing in the evidence all morning long. Thank you.